Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to learn more about the mechanics that tell cells when to divide or die, plus what scientists found when they cracked open a couple of billion-year-old meteorites. A lot of stuff coming up this hour. But first, this week, all space lovers' telescopes have been focused on Washington for the American Astronomical Society meeting. Lots of news about our universe. And joining me to talk about that and some other selected short subjects in science is Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Always good to see you, Amy.
Hi, Ira.
All right, let's talk about at the astronomy meeting. There was news about this mysterious radio bursts. Well, what is that?
Yes, this is a pretty new phenomenon as far as astronomy goes, and it's really exciting always to have something new and fresh to study. So just about 6 or 7 years ago, astronomers who worked at these giant radio telescopes around the world started to realize that there were these really interesting signals, lasted very, very short, just a couple milliseconds or shorter, and they were radio waves coming from deep in space, and they couldn't quite piece together what was causing them or what the source was. So we have a new paper out in Nature this week that's taking a look at one of those sources. They've only detected maybe around 100 of these over the years since that time. But there is one particular spot where a number of the bursts are coming from. So it's a repetitive pattern at this point, and they took a closer look at that and discovered what was behind it, possibly.
And the answer is, the envelope, please.
So they think that it might be a neutron star that is positioned perhaps very close to a massive black hole, or it could be a very young neutron star that is surrounded by this supernova cloud as the star was just formed. And they've concluded this more kind of, I guess, proposed this as a theory because they were able to measure this interesting twist that occurs in the electrical field emitted along with the radio waves. And the twist was of a nature that they've only really seen with a very strong magnetic force nearby to a source origin. And so they think that something like a massive black hole or a supernova cloud could have provided the twist that they're detecting in these radio bursts.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about this later, but black holes seem to be all kinds of places these days.
Hot place to be.
Let's move down out of the stars and to research into ibuprofen, the pain medication. A study published in the PNS suggesting that ibuprofen could depress testicular health in males. How is that played out?
Yeah, this was a small study of just about 30 or so men, and the phenomenon has been one that researchers have been interested in for a few years. This particular study, they asked the men to take a dose typical of what you might take, you know, in an average day if you were taking a pill like Advil a couple times a day to deal with a pain that you were experiencing. And over the course of, they tested them after 14 days, they tested them after 44 days, and they found that a certain hormone in these men, which is considered kind of a marker for testosterone levels, this hormone called luteinizing hormone, was increased after these periods of time taking ibuprofen on a regular basis. And basically, the luteinizing hormone that they found heightened levels in these men of, they also connect that with a lower testosterone level because luteinizing hormone is what's produced when you need to produce more testosterone. So they're sensing some sort of correlation here, and they're not exactly sure what's causing it or what the long-term effects might be, but they've certainly noted it, and it's of interest to people in the health field.
It's a small study, right? And it's people taking 44 days worth?
Over the course of a long period.
Wow, yes.
So usually, you know, for something like Advil or Motrin, maybe people are taking it on just a short period.
Right.
So there is medical, you know, advice around this where you should generally take these things as little as possible for as short a period as possible.
Now, I know that you're sitting here, so I know you're not out at the Consumer Electronics Show, and power failure and all. You were there last year. Give us a little summary of what some of the highlights were this year.
That's right. I mean, the power failure is just kind of a hilarious anecdote. Like, how ironic for that to happen at the Consumer Electronics Show when you have all these gadgets hooked up. But we do have reporters on the ground there at CES who have been writing stories for us all week, and I've certainly been following the news. And I did bring you a short list of items because I knew that you'd like hearing about them. So there's a smart couch on display this year. The smart couch has arrived. It costs $3,000.
I'll take two.
Yeah, you definitely need this for a home, right? So this is a couch that is hooked up with a built-in tablet. You can use, it's like having a remote control embedded in the sofa itself, and also has like a wireless phone charger attached. So
you maybe never have to get up out of the couch.
Exactly, which I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. And then there's also been some interesting demonstrations. A reporter, Mark Harris, wrote for us a story. He was given a ride in a self-driving car that had a remote human driver who was able to actually take over and steer the car. And you'd want this perhaps if like a self-driving car came up on a situation when it, you know, wasn't able to deal with, and this car was being driven by someone who was like 500 miles away.
So the car was like a drone then.
Exactly. Yeah, remote pilot.
A drone was on the ground.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a company called Phantom Auto, and this was one of the first public demonstrations that they've done of their technology. Kind of unnerving to think that the person steering it is doing it so over a cell network from, you know, Mountain View, California, when you're in Vegas.
What about all these devices like Alexa and Siri and Google Home and a lot of those now spreading out?
Yeah, actually, that smart couch I mentioned was Alexa-enabled so that you can just talk to it and tell it or ask it whatever you would like to ask. Yeah, I mean, we're definitely seeing, I mean, voice is supposed to be kind of the next user interaction kind of medium that we do instead of touching our screens all day and clicking on mouses. Right. So we're definitely starting to see that make its way into more and more products, for better or worse. Mm-hmm.
And finally, you have a story about turtles and climate change.
Yes.
Sounds kind of weird a little bit, this story.
It's a very unusual phenomena that's been documented by from researchers from NOAA, and certainly problematic as well. They've been studying some green sea turtles in the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, and they've been studying two particular populations. So one is from sort of the north beaches where it's a little bit warmer, and one is from the more southern beaches where it's colder. And they've noticed that actually the northern beach turtles are almost all female. So they're 99% of their juvenile turtles are female, and 86% of their adults. And it seems to be associated with this temperature of the sand that they're laying their eggs in, because these turtles, the surrounding temperature actually affects which sex they are when the eggs hatch. So this is something that they're concerned about in terms of climate change. As temperatures warm, you may actually have, they said in the near future, the complete feminization of these sea turtle populations.
There go the turtles.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, of course, all the other, you know, important species that they're connected to in these ecosystems.
Wow.
Yeah, fascinating. Really interesting study.
Scary.
Yes.
Scary and fascinating. Well, it's still good to have you, Amy.
Thank you, Ira.
Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Amy Nordstrom, news editor at the IEEE Spectrum here in New York. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now, last Sunday, SpaceX had another launch of its Falcon rockets. It was a beautiful evening launch. Maybe you saw the pictures. And the launch seemed to go according to plan, with the company successfully recovering the first stage of the rocket back at Cape Canaveral. But there's a catch. Joining me now is Lauren Grush, science writer at The Verge. She joins me by phone. Welcome back.
Hi, Ira.
Tell us about this. What's the good thing about this mystery?
Well, from what SpaceX is telling us and from what we have seen of the launch, I mean, it all went according to plan. They say that the Falcon 9 performed nominally, which in engineer speak means great. And yeah, like you said, the first stage landed, marking their 21st landing, I believe. So outwardly, all seemed to go well.
And so what's the bad news then?
Well, so Zuma was always weird to begin with. We didn't really know much about it. So when SpaceX launched it, we didn't really see it deploy in orbit because it's a classified mission, and we're not allowed to know where it's going. So then rumors started circulating on Sunday and Monday that maybe that the satellite that they had launched had either failed or had fallen back to Earth and had burned up in the atmosphere. And so then everybody was kind of scrambling to figure out what exactly happened.
Wow. So when you ask then SpaceX, what do they say?
So SpaceX is adamant that everything went according to plan. So a lot of people are asking questions, okay, so how could have it failed? Because when SpaceX says that its rockets worked well, that typically means A, it launched, B, it got the satellite to orbit, and C, it deployed the satellite into orbit. But then we started to learn some details. Over at Wired, they reported that actually the apparatus that is used to deploy the satellite into orbit wasn't actually made by SpaceX. It was made by Northrop Grumman, who manufactured the Zuma satellite. So if that thing, that apparatus called the payload adapter, failed, then the satellite might not have gone into the orbit. It would have stayed attached to the rocket. And then technically it would not have been SpaceX's fault. It would have been Northrop Grumman's fault. But I want to couch all this by saying no one really knows. That is just a working theory at this point, because it's a classified mission. We really can't say for sure, and no one's really speaking up.
So Northrop Grumman isn't saying anything either.
No, they're saying that it's classified. And then I believe during a Pentagon briefing the other day, someone asked, you know, what's up with Zuma? And then they said, oh, you got to talk to SpaceX. But SpaceX is saying, oh, no, we did everything fine. You know, got to talk to whoever the government agency is. But we don't know which government agency they flew it for. So it's kind of hard to know for sure.
Well, one thing we do know is that the SpaceX stage came back to Earth and landed well.
And if we are looking at SpaceX's activity, they are behaving as if nothing is wrong. Yeah. You know, they posted beautiful pictures of the launch, and they rolled out their new Falcon Heavy vehicle.
Tell us about that. Tell us what we're waiting for on that.
So later this month, they're going to launch their new Falcon Heavy, which is the heavy lift version of the Falcon 9. But first, they need to do a static fire, which is basically to make sure that all the engines are working properly. They go through all the propellant loading. I believe the latest news on that is that they're going to try again for tomorrow evening. They're not. I don't believe SpaceX will be live streaming, but a few space reporter friends of mine will be. So if you check on Twitter, you might get a glimpse of it online that way.
That's great. That's the new world. Lauren Grush, science writer at The Verge, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck.
Thanks for having me.
With watching the launch. When we come back, if you think chemistry and genetics are the only language your cells understand, we'll explore the mechanics that help drive cell destinies. We're going to meet a robot that gently stretches your esophagus and makes it grow a little longer. There's a whole fascinating world about pushing and pulling cells and how they make the cells grow more. We'll talk about it after the break, so stay with us.
I got my potato
on Radiolab,
and I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Now, what if I told you could make your cells grow, divide, expand, even die by simply pushing or pulling on them? You'd say, hey, I thought that was the whole role of DNA, right? Signaling when cells should do that. But now I would say you've already seen it happening around you. Skin growing, expanding to accommodate a pregnancy, right? More skin, bigger belly. Your doctor says, hey, if you want to avoid losing bone mass to osteoporosis, go lift some weights. Encourage new bone growth. So scientists, physicians have known about this mechanical stimulation for many decades, but only recently has the technology of smart robotics been brought into the picture. Here's a case in point. A new robot described in the journal Science Robotics this week sets out to harness the power of pulling. When fastened along a pig's esophagus over a period of 9 days, the robot gently stretched the tissue by more than 10 millimeters. That's 10 millimeters in 9 days, much of that from cell division alone. So for babies born with rare birth defects called esophageal atresia, this could make a real difference in their lives. So why exactly did this work, and what kinds of medical interventions could we perform with pushing and pulling or prodding robots? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about this hour. You want to join us, 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my guests. Dana Damian, a lecturer, director of the Biomedical Robotics Lab at Sheffield University in the UK, one of the creators of the esophagus tugging bot. She joins us by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Damian.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. Thank you for this invitation.
You're welcome. I'm David Mooney, professor of bioengineering at Harvard and Cambridge. Welcome, Dr. Mooney.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Dr. Damien, when I hear robot, I think it's something that walks around and maybe talks. That's not quite what you're describing, though. Describe
That's
it for
true.
Us, please.
That's true, yes. As a matter of fact, in robotics, we are very much used to see robots that manipulate, robots that walk, just as you said. So I think we've been taking a little bit of a different approach because in the body, it's not so much about manipulation, or actually, it is a bit of manipulation. It's not so much about walking, especially at the scale of a centimeter. What the body does is, or the actions that usually take place in the body is a lot about pressure and fluids running through organs through mm-hmm. the body.
Tell us about what you did in the esophagus. You put two rings in there in the esophagus?
Yes. So we have this robot that attaches to an esophagus using two rings. The robot is equipped with sensors, four sensor, a position sensor, and so we're able to measure how long we're displacing the tissue or how much force we apply to the tissue at any time during the treatment. Mm-hmm. And then, just as you said, we have a motor that can apply gentle forces on the tissue of desired values, intensities, or time duration. And so what we've done, we've applied about 2.5 millimeter tissue displacement per day over nine days. We've demonstrated in vivo trials with swine animals that we could elongate the tissue more than 77%.
Why does this happen? Do we know?
Well, there's a lot of things that we don't know for sure, and maybe David will have his better explanations than I do. But it does look like mechanical tension is a powerful driving force in the physiology of the tissue, and this the signal that cells receive through this mechanical stimulation can regulate the fate of the cell.
David, Dane has been telling us about this tissue. It's not stretching it. It's actually making new cells grow, correct?
Well, so I think the two things are related. So by applying a stretching, she's then able to induce a growth of the tissue.
Mm-hmm. And what does that cell? What does that tell us about what we thought about how cells reproduce?
Yeah, so I think it's actually a really exciting observation and finding, and certainly has great potential clinically to help a variety of different types of patients, including these children that you had mentioned earlier. On the one hand, it extends what we already know. So as you mentioned in your intro, we've long appreciated that physical forces regulate a lot of biology. If you think about it, the cells in our bodies live in a very physical world. We walk around. Gravity is always pulling on our tissues. There's blood flow through our heart and the vessels. So it makes sense that the cells would respond to these environmental signals and alter how they grow, how they die, how they specialize, and what kinds of functions that they might have. But what's really new here is now the extension of a lot of this basic knowledge into the ability to now apply defined mechanical signals and to try to drive regeneration and growth of new tissues.
Mm-hmm. And so this could possibly have an effect on people once Dr. Damien was saying, this has been proven, we've been showing it in pigs here, but now it might work in people? I mean, we might be able to do
Absolutely.
That?
Absolutely.
Tell us how. Give me some examples.
So, first of all, actually, Put this in a little bit of historical context. So we already do some of this already, even though maybe oftentimes people don't think about it. Many of us have children that we've taken to an orthodontist and had some procedures done in terms of the braces. And when you apply braces, you're also applying a physical force on the tissue, in this case, the tooth structure, to get not just the teeth to move, but the bone underneath those teeth to actually remodel. In the area of wounds, we currently have some therapies where people who have significant wounds that aren't healing well on their skin, we apply vacuum in the clinic and basically pull on those tissues to try to enhance healing. So there certainly is precedent for this that's out there. And so what I think the exciting thing here is the ability to now take this into the body and use these soft robotic systems that are very different than the hard robots that I think most of us think about from, you know, from the movies, and now be able to use those in the body because they can apply very gentle, very reproducible forces on the cells and the tissues to induce this type of remodeling and regrowth and regeneration. And not only can we do it outside the body, but we potentially, inside the body, we can potentially have these devices outside to apply these types of loads as well. So we have soft materials, and we can place these in the body surgically. We can wrap them around tissues in the body and then program them to deliver the kind of forces that we've learned are important and can drive regeneration.
Dr. Damien, how hard is it? We heard Dr. Mooney talk about putting a robot in the body. How hard is it to design a robot that's supposed to function inside the human body?
Excuse me. It is quite challenging, and it surely depends on the clinical condition that we are targeting to resolve. We've been going through a lot of trials and uncertainties in designing this robotic implant. And to tell you the truth, when I first saw it actually working, I felt like I'm controlling a rover on Mars, just because it is an inaccessible place. And so once we place it there inside, we need to make sure that it's going to work 100% of the time. And I think this is a huge challenge. We need to go through many stages of design. So how can we design such a robot that takes into account not only the targeted tissue, but also the environment around? So we have soft tissue like the esophagus, like the lungs, but we also have hard tissue, speaking about the robotic implant that we've developed, such as ribs. And so we want to have a robot that is both soft, but is also durable.
Right.
And it took us quite a while to understand all these uncertainties in order to embed the requirements in this design. So we've come up with an encapsulation that is soft, it's wrinkled, in order to take into account that gentle interaction with the soft tissue. But we also had to embed polyester mesh inside it, just in order to take into account the stress from the ribs,
right,
which may tear the encapsulation in time, and that would be so devastating for both the human or the animal, as well as for the robot, because we have a lot of electronics inside, which can oxidize or which can short, just because there's going to be some fluid running into the input.
Dr. Mooney, people are going to listen. I'm sorry. People are going to listen to this and say, hey, I have a child who's suffering from this or that, or I have a friend. This is not ready for humans yet, is it?
Not the type of intervention we're talking about today, but as in many types of advances in medicine, there will be a stepwise transition. Mm-hmm. So to put these devices in the body, as we just heard, has a lot of challenges, and there will have to be a lot of work done to make sure that can be done safely and reproducibly. But if, for example, we instead are applying these outside the body, it actually lowers the bars and the hurdles to do it substantially. And that's something that you have the opportunity to move much more quickly, I think, towards human clinical trials. If you think about it, today many people already get massage therapy, which is in some ways similar to what we're talking about today, where an individual pushes and pulls on tissues to try to alter. Now, in massage, we typically don't know exactly what it is we're manipulating, and it's also difficult, if not impossible, to have a defined and repeatable force done over and over again multiple days. But with a soft robotic that you place outside the body, you can accomplish that. So how I see this playing out is we'll have devices outside the body initially that can induce regeneration of certain tissues, probably not the ones deep inside body organs, and then as those get developed and go to the clinic, then we'll be continuing to make advances on these internal soft robotic devices.
Mm-hmm. How would this interact with stem cell research? You know, what you're saying, reproducing cells, is a lot of what stem cell research is aimed at. Can this robotics idea and the pushing and pulling do away with some of the need to use stem cells in some certain cases?
Yeah, so it's a really provocative idea that instead of culturing outside the body and transplanting stem cells, which is how most of us think about regenerative medicine happening today, to instead directly target those cells in the body that already exist, and for example, as you're saying, apply a certain stress to induce them to proliferate and then have them specialize and become the tissue type of interest. There is proof of principle for that already. For example, in the area of skeletal muscle, it's been demonstrated that one can induce regeneration of muscle, which is caused by a stem cell population, simply by applying mechanical cues. In what we're talking about with Damien's work, at this point, it's not completely clear if there is a stem cell contribution, but at the end of the day, there likely is at least some stem cells that are participating in the building of the bulk of the tissue or the blood vessels. So likely stem cells are being targeted there. Hmm. And we have found in the lab many groups that stem cells are exquisitely sensitive to these types of physical cues.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Dana Damian and Dr. David Mooney, talking about the mechanically manipulating cells to get them to move. And what about in cancer cells? If we push and pull cancer cells the right way, might we disable
them?
That's
actually, again, a really striking concept. If you think about it, how we oftentimes detect cancer, if you think about breast cancer, when a woman does a self-exam, she's actually looking for a region of the breast tissue that's stiffer. So we intrinsically know that there's a different mechanical environment for cancer, and people have appreciated this for a long period of time. So that naturally led to the question of whether cancer, whether the stiffness is a result of the cancer or perhaps it actually causes the cancer. And over the last decade or so, there's been a tremendous amount of work that's shown that the mechanical environment of cancerous cells plays a really dramatic role in their further development of malignancy, their ability to move and migrate and colonize other parts of the body. And so that actually is an area where there's a lot of research now to try to alter the mechanical environment of cancer cells to try to, in essence, either prevent them from being able to metastasize, or perhaps even return them back to a normal state.
Let me see if I can
and
get a...
so that's
yeah,
a...
That's sounds
oh, no, please go ahead.
Sounds exciting. I just want to see if I can get a call in from a listener before we have to go. Quentin in San Antonio. Hi, Quentin.
Hi.
Go
How
ahead.
How are you doing? I'd like to ask, you said the experiment lasted for 9 days.
Yep.
Didn't function normally or if required IV fluids.
Yeah, he sort of dropped out a little bit. So you're asking, was the pig able to eat and function normally with the robot
yes.
on? Dr. Damian?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, I heard that. Yes, the short answer is yes. And the long answer, to explain it to you better, we've mounted that robot on a healthy esophagus, not so non-interrupted esophagus, and so we would have a normal tube basically, and while the animal can keep on moving and eating and drinking water, we are doing, or the robot is doing, the job that it's supposed to do.
Can you give us other kinds of illnesses yeah. that you might, or other different kind of tissue you might aim, Dr. Damian?
Sure. So we've targeted currently the esophagus because it's a rather simple soft tissue. It has mostly role in the transportation of the food from the mouth to the stomach, and then it has some muscular layers there in order to transport the food. But we're also looking now at the short bowel. There is this devastating condition called short bowel syndrome, where children are born with a shorter bowel. So that means they have an impaired digestion. And so we have, from our preliminary trials, it looks like we can also elongate this tissue.
Mm-hmm. And for adults who have bowel shortening surgery, might this?
Yes, it looks like this could also apply, yet this is something that we still have to demonstrate.
Wow, well, this is quite interesting. As I said before, this is not a new finding. We've known for decades about this happening, and yet it's now coming to the fore right now as new research is published about how successful your researchers have been on. I want to thank both of you, Dana Damian, a lecturer, director of the Biomedical Robotics Lab, Sheffield University in the UK, and one of the creators of the esophagus tugging bot, and Dr. David Mooney, professor of bioengineering at Harvard in Cambridge. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, too.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. Well, we'll follow this as new data and new research comes out. It's quite fascinating about an old idea being resurrected. We're going to take a break, and after the break, meteorites that fell to Earth two decades ago. Scientists have cracked them open and found the stuff of life in them. Stay with us. It's kind of really cool. We'll talk about it after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, when meteorites fall to Earth, they bring with them a taste of what's out there in our solar system. And for two meteorites, the Monahans and Zag, that crash-landed here in 1998, that taste was quite salty. Each meteorite contained blue salt crystals that the asteroids picked up on their violent trajectories toward Earth. And now, two decades later, scientists have taken a closer look at those crystals and discovered organic compounds that make up the building blocks of life. Let me bring on my guest to talk about it, Dr. Queenie Chan, former researcher at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, now at the Open University in the UK. Dr. Chan, welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, 5 to 8 hours apart across the Atlantic from the UK. Thank you for having me here, Ira. I'm very excited.
Very happy to have you. Please tell us, what's the story with these two meteorites with these funny names? Where and when did scientists find them? Where did they come from?
Yeah, so these two meteorites, they both fell in the year 1998, 20 years ago already. They got their name from the town where they fall. So the first one being the Monahans. It is fell in a town called Monahans in Texas. It was fell in next to a basketball court, actually, with kids playing around. So it was some kids who found it. So they were about maybe 13 years old or 10 years old, so 20 years after nowadays, they may be of my age now. So the other meteorite is Zag, which was fell in Morocco also in the same year. And we're lucky that both meteorites fell at a really dry environment, so it was kind of protected from terrestrial contamination and got retrieved really quickly and kept at NASA Johnson Space Center in nitrogen cabinet to avoid all this contamination. So very exciting meteorites.
So why did you have to wait 20 years before you could do more research on them?
Yeah, so it's a funny thing, because 20 years ago, there were instruments that was available, like the gas chromatography, mass spectrometry was available at that time to study organic compounds inside of meteorite. But we are looking at the salt crystals within the meteorites. So the salt crystals are very small. Each of them are maybe about 2 meter in size. So in order to study the amino acids or organic compound just within the salt crystal is really challenging. So just a few years ago, this a technology called the ultra performance liquid chromatography has become available to us. And nowadays, We used to have to use about 100 milligrams of meteorite sample, for example, for GCMS, gas chromatography analysis, to look at the amino acid contents. Of course, it depends on how much amino acids you've got in the sample, but usually, typically about 100 milligram. And for the salt crystals, the blue stunning salt crystal that we got was about 3 milligrams. So
that's,
it's not
a lot
even
less.
A tenth of it. Yeah. So we need the technology, the sensitivity for studying the amino acid contents.
So what did you learn anything new from the salt crystals?
So it's other than the meteorite ball fell in the same year, got retrieved really quickly from a dry environment, they share something else in common. So first of all, these two meteorites were found to be heated from 600 to 550 degrees Celsius, which is about 1700 degrees Fahrenheit, very high temperature. And but at the same time, they host blue salt crystals that were found to contain liquid water. So this liquid water, this water was found as in a liquid form. When we open it, look at it under the microscope, we could see the liquid floating inside of the blue salt crystal. We saw a little bubble, and when we moved the sample around, we saw the bubble moving here and there. So we know there is some sort of liquid inside of the salt crystal. So this is something already quite phenomenal.
Well, wait a minute. You found liquid water inside the salt crystal of a meteorite that's been in that meteorite for how long?
As almost as old as the meteorite. It was 4.5 billion year old.
So it's been traveling around the cosmos for 4 to 5 billion years with a little bubble of water in it.
Yeah, exactly. And it was found...
Mind blown today.
I was not the first person to find the liquid water. It was my advisor, also a co-author of this paper, found the liquid water for the first time. So it was astonishing the first time when we found it. And then we wonder, okay, so we found liquid water. What comes with it? Is there any organic compound? So that's why we look at the organic composition of these salt crystal containing liquid water inside of them.
And it came from where? I understand Ceres. Is that what you think it came from?
That's what we think the salt crystals are from.
Yeah.
But it is interesting because when we're talking about the meteorite, as I was saying, it was heated up to 1700 degrees Fahrenheit, right? So at that temperature, water would have gone, would have left the salt crystal. So the fact that we're still seeing salt crystal with the water in our lab, meaning that the salt crystal could be coming from another asteroid, different from Zag and Monahan's asteroid themselves.
So it picked up a hitchhiker? The water is a hitchhiker from another asteroid?
The salt crystal is a hitchhiker from an asteroid. Yeah, that probably Ceres or any other object or asteroid really rich in water, maybe having a water-like ocean, really organic-rich kind of asteroid.
Wow, so this is not very common. I'm getting the drift here.
not common at all that we find liquid water plus organic molecule in the same pocket.
Wow, where can we see it? Is it on exhibit anywhere? Are you just studying it? Or
this is... So we had, so when I opened, so what we did to extract the amino acids or organic compounds out of it, we had for example, the Zag meteorite, we had it about, the sample size is about 15 centimeter across. So it's a pretty big piece of meteorite.
Yeah.
But in order to take the little tiny salt crystal out, the blue salt crystal out, I have to break the meteorite open little by little. So the entire 15 centimeter meteorite was broke open into something about half a meter, half a centimeter size.
Yeah.
So at that time, it's a mystery box. We don't know what you would get. We don't know if you're getting, it's like the early, it's like the quite fancy mystery box nowadays, isn't
it? Yeah,
I got it.
You buy it, you don't know what's in it.
You don't know what it is.
All right, Dr. Chen, I've got to go. This is fascinating. Congratulations
to
you and your team.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Queenie Chan, former researcher at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, now with the Open University in the UK. For the past year, we've been profiling scientists in our breakthrough Portraits of Women in Science video series, getting a closer look at how their lives and work intersect. Today is our final installment. Emily Driscoll, producer on Breakthrough, is here to tell us about the series. Emily.
Hi, Ira. Thanks.
You produced a number of these videos. What themes were you looking at?
So Breakthrough Portrait of Women in Science, it's an anthology of six short films that follow women in science across STEM fields. And the goal is to show the challenges and also the excitements of what it's like to be a scientist. And what struck me in following six of these incredible stories is how a lot of these scientists had overcame really immense challenges, whether they're cultural, a disability, or very tough field work. And these obstacles became motivation.
Yeah.
Or allowed them to see their research in a different way. For example, Dr. Bariba, she grew up in Algeria. She excelled at math, She had tuberculosis in her family. And now, fast forward, she's a fluid dynamicist at MIT, and she films sneezes in extreme slow motion to see how the droplets are traveling to better understand disease transmission. And similarly, we went to the Indian Space Agency, ISRO, and saw the individual challenges of the scientists as well as the team science, the team challenges. How do you get to Mars on an extremely limited budget and when the country's never done that before?
It's a fascinating series. We're going to tell people how to get to see the whole series later. And congratulations to you, Emily.
Thank you.
On a great series. And in fact, we have the latest installment up there, and I'm going to talk about that right now. Joining us now is Carletta Chief, who is featured in our latest breakthrough video. She's Assistant Professor of Soil, Water, and Environmental Science at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and she's been monitoring the waterways of her community in the Navajo Nation. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. It's great to be on the show, and it's truly a big honor for me.
Oh, we're very happy to have you. Thank you very much. I know you're a hydrologist, and growing up in the Navajo Nation, what got you interested in going into science and studying water?
Well, I grew up on the Navajo Nation without electricity or running water, and my family lived within the Peabody leasehold area, and our family was heavily impacted by the mining, and we had to move. Meanwhile, while they were mining all this coal and using groundwater to transport it, our family didn't have power or running water. And so at a very young age, I was questioning why this was happening and why our land was being mined. And I came into this role of being the translator for my family and doing things for my family related to the mining impacts. And my family encouraged me to go to college, and I just I really enjoyed science in school.
Yeah, so you went. So you went to college at Stanford, and in 2015. There was a spill from the Gold King mine that affected the Animas River that flows through the Navajo Nation. And you found that how the residents were using the river was very different from how the EPA characterized how people should use it, or people did use it.
Yes, the Navajo people have a really deep connection to the river and the environment in their cultural practices, their beliefs, even their clans. And so I already knew from the beginning that our people use the river in many different ways. And it's common knowledge amongst the people there and the environmental managers. So we were able to document this through surveys that we administered to 60 households living along the San Juan River.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flato. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Dr. Carletta Chief, a hydrologist from University of Arizona in Tucson, and so you studied how the water was entering, was coming out of the mine, and then it was polluted.
Yes, there are over 11,000 mines up in this region of southern Colorado, and many of them are legacy mining activities that occurred back in the late 1800s that spanned about 120 years. And so currently the EPA is dealing with trying to remediate these mines. And so while they were doing these activities, one of their contractors accidentally dislodged a plug that was holding back a large volume of acid mine drainage.
And it was then affecting the drinking water. And you mentioned in the video that there were like hundreds of ways that the Navajo community was using this water.
Yes, and so we documented over 400 ways that the Navajo community members are using this river, including cultural, spiritual, recreational, livelihood, and arts and crafts. And so this gives us information that there are potential exposure pathways that a Navajo could have if they were using the river and it had exceeded the, you know, the levels of different metals, and that could be a potential health risk to people. So it gave us information that shows us that there are more exposure pathways than EPA had come up with initially.
So you were sort of the counterbalance to the EPA here, explaining things.
It was an honor to have the opportunity to help my community in a way, in a situation where there needed to be more cultural sensitivity. Also, I had built a lot of the partnerships with the communities through the Superfund research program here at the U of A. And so I had been working in impacts of mining. And so it was the opportunity to build upon those efforts because I had those partnerships. I'm from the community, and I was able to work with cultural experts to also help me communicate the science.
Mm-hmm. And the status of the river is now cleaner, but you say there's more needs to be done.
Yes. Well, the EPA actually deemed the water to meet agricultural standards several weeks after the spill. However, it's they are currently having long-term monitoring plan in place. And our work is really to look at the one-year short-term exposure to the spill. And so we're wrapping up that work now as a result of funding we received from the National Institute of Health. And we're continuing on to look at long-term efforts, which is funded by the U of A Howery Foundation. And we're going to be looking at emergency response, citizen science, and working with the community to look at the resiliency to future spills.
Well, congratulations to you, and good luck to you, Dr. Chief.
Thank you.
Carlotta Chief is assistant professor and extension specialist at the Soil, Water, and Environmental Science Unit at the University of Arizona in Tucson. You can watch Dr. Chief and all the breakthrough videos on our website at sciencefriday.com, when we'll be screening the entire Breakthrough Portraits of Women in Science series at select Alamo Draft House locations across the country. And you can check for details at sciencefriday.com/portraits. One last thing before we go. Last week, we kicked off a monstrous winter book club with Mary Shelley's 1818 novel Frankenstein. You can join the fun and get details on our website at sciencefriday.com/book club. And Amy from Boca Raton called to remind us that Mary Shelley was the daughter of a noted feminist, Mary Wollstonecraft.
It's phenomenal how in women's studies classes the book Frankenstein is also used beyond the scientific applications of it all.
And this week, our question for our book club listeners: does any modern science remind you of Frankenstein or his monster? Call us at 567-243-2456. 567-243-2456. We might play your comment on the air next week. Charles Berkowitz, our director, senior producer Christopher Intagliata, producers Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Haller, and we had technical help, as always, from Rich Kim, Sarah Fishman, and Jack Horwitz. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.